Hey guys, I'm Adam Rappaport, and this is the Bon Appetit Foodcast. All right, before we get started, I have a very exciting announcement. We will be hosting yet another live podcast at the end of this month. On January 29th at 6 p.m., we will again be at the wonderful Bell House in Brooklyn. And we know that the end of January is kind of the most depressing time of the year outside, so we'll be talking about how wonderful it is to hole up inside in your sweatpants and cook. Winter comforts is the name of the game. We'll be joined by truly special guests, Stella Bugbee, editor-in-chief of The Cut, and New Yorker columnist Gia Tolentino, as well as Carla Lali Music, Chris Morocco, Andy Baragani, Molly Boz, and Sola El Whaley from the VA Test Kitchen. They'll all be appearing on stage along with myself and VA editors Priya Krishna and Alex Beggs. As always, there will be bites and a cash bar. And the link to read all of the details and buy tickets is in our podcast show notes. So a thank you to Target for making this event possible. We cannot wait. And now for this week's show. Up first, Associate Editor Christina Che is chatting with Sonoko Sakai, cookbook author and soba noodle maker, whose new book, Japanese Home Cooking, the BA staff cannot get enough of. After that, Brad Leone is on talking with me about an often overlooked category of the produce aisle that he loves deeply and truly, root vegetables. And finally, after a short hiatus over the holiday break, it's back to Cook, Marry, Kill with Alex Beggs. All right, here we go.
Hi, Sonoko. Thank you so much for coming in.
Oh, hello, Christina. Thank you for inviting me.
So we just spent the last hour or so watching you make these incredible soba noodles that you've become known for. And I feel like I'm like still coming down from it. There was so much energy, and I feel like people were just so engrossed in watching you. And
thank you.
One thing that really surprised me, I mean, so many things surprised me. Mm-hmm. I feel like I could go on for days about all the technique that I feel like we learned. But one thing that struck me so much was when you were talking about the relationship or the similarities between soba making and pottery. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's hard to talk about without a visual, but I was wondering if you could sort of summarize, you know, what you were saying earlier.
Yes. Well, basically, pottery is clay and water, right? Or the way you make clay is with mud and water. And a dough is very similar because it's ground groats or ground buckwheat groats with water. And it's just mixing that together to make this dough and then kneading it out into flour. And there's just certain folds that are traditionally very similar to making pottery. I've never really done pottery myself, but I am so tempted. Like, I think my next phase in life might actually be doing a pottery class. But right now I'm like focused on just trying to become a better noodle maker or soba maker. So one thing at a time. But every time I run into a potter, they go, oh my God, I could do that fold.
I mean, one thing that I noticed too was that so much of it was like muscle memory for you.
Yeah.
I feel like we were watching you roll out the dough and you were looking at the thickness of the sheet and you were cutting it and tapping your knife against it. And all of that was done through memory.
Yes. I mean, I've been at it for about 10 years now. And first I was just basically a soba slurper, right? I just loved soba. I come from the Kanto region where we eat a lot of soba noodles. Noodles could be very regional in Japan, and some people prefer udon over soba. But so when I really had this, you know, I became very homesick about my soba noodles, and I could not compromise just eating dried noodles, which is what you mostly get here, or machine-made noodles, and it's mostly wheat. So I started taking classes in Japan, and then I did a little bit of an estage with a soba master, and I kind of worked my way through this exercise of learning how to use my muscles.
So jumping back a bit, you've grown up living in a lot of different places around the world, right?
Yes. Uh-huh. I was actually born here in New York.
Oh, you were?
Yes. Queens.
Whereabouts? Oh.
Queens. Yeah, my name Sonoko actually is garden child because it's Kew Gardens.
Oh, wow.
And I'm the first American born child.
Of your siblings?
Yes. Uh-huh. Of five.
And which one are you?
I'm this number two.
And so where else did you grow up?
Well, it's New York, then Tokyo to San Francisco, Mexico City, back to Japan, Tokyo, and Kamakura is another city outside of Tokyo, and then to Los Angeles.
And were you eating, I mean, did you have access to the foods that you wanted to be eating all that time? Like, were you able to eat soba when you were...
Not all the time. I think it was more udon, more wheat-based noodles. And soba is something that I actually acquired a taste for when I moved back to Japan after Mexico. So that I was probably about 8 or 9 years old. Mm-hmm. And my grandmother loved soba, so she would take me to a soba place. She didn't make her soba.
Ever?
Never made soba. I had never seen her make soba. She was a baker, actually. She baked bread.
Uh-huh.
And we stomped on
That's
the dough
unusual.
With our feet. Yeah, my grandmother... is very kind of westernized. She was had a very Western upbringing, went to Catholic schools, and so she baked cakes and breads for church. And I really got my hands in flour through her baked goods.
Right. And I guess when I say unusual, I mean it feels unusual for a culture where baked goods baked in an oven feels...
Yeah. No, we were my grandmother was the only person who had an oven. So everybody in town
in her
come.
Like in her town?
Yes. And people would come and also butter was very unusual. So to have butter accessible, my grandmother, baked these cakes with butter. So yeah, people would smell something very different. And this is back in the 60s. So.
And was it a luxury? And was butter considered like a luxury item?
Yeah. Well, after the war... butter became more accessible. But when my mother first moved to the United States, to New York, she just was so impressed that she could actually afford to buy butter, right? And milk. But it's so funny because they're sort of my grandma mother. They made all these traditional foods and modern foods. But I became more traditional, even though I've spent most of my life overseas.
Right, right. You were sort of Western born.
Yes. Mexican, part American, part Japanese.
But it feels like, and I can feel this when I read through your book, it really feels like you were drawn to something about your ancestral roots and mm-hmm. that style of cooking.
Yeah, it was almost like an awakening for me when I moved back from Mexico to Japan. That's at the age of 8 or 9. Mexico was also an awakening culturally because it was still a culture of handicrafts, right? People still made a lot of things by hand. But when I went back to Japan, that interest, curiosity in me heightened because we lived in Kamakura in a place where there's many, it's the city of where Zen Buddhism flourished. So lots of temples and shrines, and where there are lots of temples and shrines, there's lots of artisans who make the tofu. There's good tea there. There's tea ceremonies. The ocean was very close. The sea was close. So we got fresh seafood and a lot of noodle places. So this is something that, going to school, or I would pass by these artisan shops and peek in, and there would be somebody making something by hand. And that's what I mean by a cultural awakening. And it stayed with me.
So when you started to develop a deeper interest in making soba noodles, were you also at the same time developing an interest in the broader subject of Japanese home cooking, or was it sort of one following the other?
Actually, I had written a book 30 years ago, 34
oh, that's
years
right,
ago.
Which I was actually shocked to learn that existed. When I was doing my research.
Yes, it was called The Poetical Pursuit of Food.
Which I love.
Yes, and Japanese Recipes for American Cooks. So I've always been interested in Japanese home cooking, and I wanted to find my voice in English. So that was the first book I wrote when I was still in my... I started in my late 20s. I had an Olivetti typewriter that was missing several keys, but I typed it manually. And I'm still very proud of this book. It has absolutely no pictures, a few illustrations. It's very esoteric, but with lots of recipes. And I think the principles still stand today.
And that's under your maiden name, right?
Yes. My maiden name is Sonoko Kondo. Now I'm Sonoko Sakai. Actually, my Christian name is Marie. I was Marie Kondo.
What?
I'm the original Marie Kondo. If you didn't know, if you look at my birth certificate from Kew Gardens Hospital, it's Marie Sonoko Kondo. So I grew up as Marie. Everybody up to high school called me Marie Kondo.
That is amazing. Do you keep in touch with anyone from high school?
Of course. Well, she's my elementary
school. Oh,
right.
Yeah, right.
But I have, yes.
Do they find it funny?
Yeah, they call me Marie, and... even my husband said, somebody wrote a cookbook with the same name. That's not a cookbook, the organizing book.
Your alter ego.
Yes, my alter ego completely like beat you. She's selling millions of copies and I'm going, what?
I've met her in this office.
Oh my God.
I feel that she's about half as tall as you. She is the smallest person I've ever seen.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, she's like a doll. And she has like the most porcelain-like beautiful skin. And the way I think about, you know, my way of organizing is like chaos, you know, organized chaos, people call me. I eventually get to things. And I, like my grandmother, I don't want to throw everything away. You know, things give me joy later in life. So,
right.
You know, like my pots and pans or old things actually start to take on a different value.
Investment joy.
Yeah.
Or, I don't know.
But it's kind of funny that I'm a Marie Kondo.
That's hilarious.
Yeah.
So, yes, to speak to your first cookbook, I was really surprised to learn that that existed already because this came out, 30-some years ago?
35 years ago.
And, I mean, that's older than I've been alive by a few years.
Yeah.
But sometimes I've noticed, I'm trying to think, I was at a used cookbook store in Biddeford in Maine a couple of years ago, and I was looking through all the different sections and they had it organized by different regional cuisines and global cuisines, and the Asian cookbook section was very small, and I'm Korean. And so I was really surprised to find that it was really hard to find cookbooks written for American cooks by people of Asian descent.
Right.
And I just thought that was very interesting.
So I was like, I think a little bit ahead of my time. And I was still, you know, when I was writing it, I was a graduate student at UCLA. And
Not studying.
Yeah, I wasn't doing culinary, I was in film. And my professor that I was working for said, you know, you have a story to tell, you have a voice, right? You know, find your voice in cooking, you're a good cook. So he kind of guided me and I put this book together.
Tell me about that book and how it compares to the new book, which is actually, it's much more straightforward title, Japanese Home Cooking.
Yeah.
But it feels like the spirits of the two
I think the poetical pursuit is the same because I think, as I said earlier, you know, I had this cultural awakening and it was poetry. You know, everybody that worked with their hands, including like the rice miller, had so much respect. You know, he revered his rice. And he wrote a haiku on the chalkboard every morning, and I would read it. And that's how I learned Japanese, right? And so I wanted to capture that moment in my life. But I still feel that 30-some years later, I still have that every day. You know, you just have to look at life a little closer, right? And capture that decisive moment when you find things that are poetical, especially in cooking or, you know, when you're working in the garden. And so I feel that I have evolved as a person. I'm older. I'm my grandma's age. I have two grandchildren. I mean, you know, I have wrinkles. I can't deny that. But, you know, it's like you the experience has really, of just being in the kitchen and cooking for my family and friends, have made me a richer person. So I ask myself, how dare you wrote that cookbook when you were like in your, you know, 20s, right? Like, but, you know, back then I had a different kind of passion.
So. I mean, and I feel like the most notable difference, of course, is that you hadn't even begun your soba journey.
Oh, no. I was using dried noodles. And udon, my brother got into noodle making udon. So we would do that. But it was more about cakes and, you know, my sister ended up being a pastry chef. She studied in France and Belgium.
Oh,
she's the one who took it seriously. And I was just like, I deviated and went into something else and film. But, you know, it's the more I pursued cooking, especially Japanese cooking, I wanted to get to the ingredient, and then I wanted to get into handling the ingredient with respect.
That has always been something that that struck me about Japanese culture, and especially the artisan culture, where you can have, you know, the name of your tofu maker, and you have someone who's dedicated their whole life to the pursuit of perfection in, you know, tamago, or you know, which of course was made very famous by I forget his name. He's a the guy who cooked the tamago for Jiro in Jiro Dreams of Sushi. Basically, there's like this sub-narrative in Jiro Dreams of Sushi where the guy spends 10 years
Yeah, he must be the guy in Tsukiji. I mean, there are people like that who do nothing but just the tamago yaki, right?
Right.
So that particular person was probably featured, but I have to say that there are many artisans like that that spend all their life doing just one thing, the one thing really well.
Right. That feels like something that is uniquely Japanese.
I don't know. And it's like generational, right? It just doesn't end at one, in one, you know, it's not just one person doing it, but it gets transferred to the next generation. And now they're sort of losing that art because nobody wants to do things that are so labor intensive or takes a lot of training. So I feel like the culture is lost. The traditions are lost. But as a home cook, I said, well, what can I do to preserve my culinary culture? I'm not trying to become like a shokunin. That's the word for artisan. That's what they do for a living. I'm a home cook. I'm a cooking teacher. I like to do it on a level that is accessible to people.
So you're not in the business of becoming a quote unquote soba master.
Oh, I'll never be a soba master. I'm a soba maker. I'm a cook.
One thing I was wondering too is, with a title like master, you know, I feel like there's like a udon master or soba master. Is that something that actually comes with a specific certification process, or, you know, it's just, how do people become recognized as master?
Well, there's
status?
no word as master in Japan. Or you could say sensei or you know, a teacher. Mm-hmm. But shokunin is someone who works with his hands. And if somebody says, I'm a shokunin, you have to prove it, right? You have to go and see his work.
Right.
And the work will speak for itself. You're not going to go out and tell people, hey, call me a master. That's not the way it works. It's the practice, and it has to show. And the reason why I say that I'm a soba maker is because it's not something I do every single day in volumes. That's what a real soba master does. Mm-hmm. And he gets his respect if his soba is really good. There's also a lot of mediocre soba out there, you know? So, I mean, this is, again, you know, a pursuit of perfection could be one word. I don't know if perfection is what people pursue, because I don't think there's such thing as perfection, but...
Right. I feel like it's perhaps just a pursuit of something a little bit better every day.
Yeah, right, right.
A little bit better over
time. Yeah, and I think it's very important to have that humble spirit, the beginner's spirit, and we call it chushin. You always have to get back to this beginner's spirit, and that's how I approach my soba making.
And it feels like a quality that you have to have if you're going to be doing, you know, you're going through the same motions of doing something you've done hundreds of times before every day and approaching it as if it's the first time.
Yeah.
There's like something very, there is something very poetical about that.
Yeah, and it's different every day. The weather could be different.
Oh, right.
You might feel a little different.
And you were noticing just now that the air quality in the building here is super dry.
Right. So I know that the soba is going to react to that. And if I don't pay attention, it's going to turn into like a very dry, you know, fragile soba. So it does require that you focus.
Okay, so this brings me to your new book, which just came out, called Japanese Home Cooking, Simple Meals, Authentic Flavors. I was very excited to get this book.
Thank you.
And so, of course, this does include instructions for how to make soba noodles at home, but it also has a ton of other recipes that you might find in a typical Japanese kitchen. And, you know, there were things I feel like I recognized, the Japanese curry, of course, or yakisoba, or, you know, so many other things, the nabes, the hot pots. And I just wanted to know about what your inspiration was for how you decided to publish this collection of recipes.
Mm-hmm. Well, I always wanted to do a sequel to the first one. And it's taken me, you know, over 30 years to do it. But
and you wrote a book in between, right?
Oh, a little one, a little gifty book called Rice Crab.
An onigiri book.
Yeah, that's just because I needed to break into this market, you know, because I went into film for 30 years. I was buying movies.
Right.
So, but it's very similar in that you're sourcing good ingredients and making something out of it. But anyway.
So you kind of see this as the follow-up to your first book.
Yes, it is. And it's basically standing on the same fundamentals. But, you know, I introduce ideas about Gogyosetsu, which is wuxing in Chinese, and it's about the five principles that we practice as a cook. And it, whether it's your five senses or five colors or five techniques, we like to wrap things up nicely in fives. And or you go to a temple and you see, or a shrine and you see the five grains. It's not just rice that's revered. It's millet, rice, barley, and soybean, beans included, and buckwheat, let's see. And we think of balance or harmony when you have a variety of ingredients that come together. And if you just do one thing, it's not going to work. If you just grow rice, you know, you deplete the nutrients from the soil. So I think you have to look at cooking the same way. I'm always looking about color balance. I'm looking about flavor balance. No single flavor should stand out too much. These are all things that I learned through experience. You know, sometimes like we do, like garnishes, you can't overwhelm your plate with a lot of herbs and flowers. We tend to do that here in the West, I think.
Right.
But they all...
Big smattering
oh
of
my gosh,
chopped
you know,
parsley and
a big
cilantro
rose
over everything.
On it or no, but they all have these rolls in Japan. And they have some like sliced, like grated ginger or grated radish on the side of soba noodles. That aids in digestion. You're not going to serve a whole cup of that. Or wasabi is served with fish, right? You know, it clears the toxins and helps in digestion. They have medicinal rolls.
Right.
So you have to understand how much of it to put. You never want to overwhelm it. But some people just want a lot of ginger, you know. It goes, can I have another ginger? And you see these sushi bars with tons of ginger. And it's
how
kind
does
of
that make you feel?
Appalling, you know. So through my experience, I learned more about balance and harmony. And I don't think I had, I touch on it in my first book, but I went deeper in this book.
So the book is interesting to me because it's divided into two parts. And the first part, like the first half of the book is largely dedicated to talking about the pantry and all the ingredients that comprise it.
Yeah. I wanted people to understand the pantry, because if you don't understand it, you could go to a Japanese market and be lost. It's too foreign.
I certainly feel that way.
Like if I go to a Korean, let's say, market and I can't read the, you know, the language, then how am I going to find anything? And but if I could recognize some of the things, or have tasted miso or soy sauce, there's different kinds of soy sauce. I thought, well, you know, I'm going to try to describe it, try to explain as much as I can so people don't feel intimidated by Japanese seasonings. And when you really look at it, it's there's only like five seasonings. Again, there's five.
And what are they?
Well, there's salt, of course. That's universal.
Shio.
And there's miso, soy sauce, mirin, or sake. They're both sakes. And there's vinegar. And they're all basically, except with the exception of salt, they're all fermented seasonings made with rice. So if you know those five, then you could cook Japanese food.
Right. I remember that always, that surprised me when I was first starting to get into learning how to make dashi and, you know, making basic seasonings and stuff. I was like, everything I make has the same things
in it. I know, it's really...
Just variations on the same thing.
I know, I mean, I think other Asian cuisines are more complex when it comes to spices. I mean, we have togarashi, which is a chili pepper, and wasabi, but and ginger. But, you know, no cardamom, no turmeric.
Right.
The curry is a different animal, right? It just, it came through, it's from India through the British. But, and yes, Japanese cuisine has become very modern and westernized on many levels. And I touch upon that in the second part of the book. But the first part of the book, I said I have to introduce, get people to understand the fundamentals. And once you understand like how the dashi is put together, so simple. Don't buy the dashi powder. Just all you have to do is soak the seaweed, or do a, you know, you could do a cold brew with shiitake mushrooms, and you have a broth that can be the foundation for your miso soup. And then you build on it. So I wanted people to take that pantry section and build, comfortably build, you know, one block at a time.
And when people are shopping for these things, you know, I mean, if I were to go out and look for, I mean, basic things, soy sauce or sesame oil or, you know, whatever, what would your advice be in terms of buying those things in terms of, the, I suppose, the quality level? which I only ask because I've been fortunate enough to taste different grades of these products over the course of my life, and I've really been blown away by the difference between, you know, like a Kikkoman soy sauce and, you know, some soy sauce that Nancy Singleton Hachisu brought in to the kitchen.
Right. Well, so you have the industrial soy sauce that, you know, is produced very quickly. No time for fermentation. They use some kind of a base and they do it in less than a month or, you know, a couple months versus the whole bean soy sauce that takes a long time to ferment, like, you know, at least a year. And the umami level is completely different.
It's
and
crazy.
And the intensity of the salt is different, right? Same with the vinegar. A lot of the vinegars are using a base. It's like ice cream. If you use an ice cream base, the ice cream doesn't taste good.
Right.
But a lot of them use that, right? Because it's easier, it's cheaper, it yields more.
It's like the feeling of eating something that doesn't quite leave you satisfied in the end.
Yeah,
it doesn't sate your palate.
No. And unfortunately, most of the industrial soy sauces just are not.
Don't cut it.
Don't cut it for me. But even like Kikkoman and Yamasa, they have whole beans. They have organic. They're actually seeing the demand of the consumers, and they're making a higher grade soy sauce because they're the ones that started the soy sauce. So it's important for them to keep their customers. So I see higher grade soy sauce.
Which is great because I think the consumers are learning from people like you who are writing these really great resources for people to learn.
Sure.
And certainly I know that I've learned a lot from reading this book. Okay, I just have one last question, which is more of a personal one, but please tell me there is a soba restaurant in the cards for you. And if so, can I come?
Well, I just did a pop-up. And I made 120 servings for a restaurant in Venice, California, called Mountain. And I managed, and I felt so
Travis's
good.
Oh, Travis's place.
Yeah, I felt so good. I felt like I don't want to tell you how old I am, but I have two grandchildren. So, but I have an amazing amount of energy. So if there's an opportunity to have a little soba shop, why not, right? But I haven't, you know, the thing is, for me, it's about quality of the ingredients. You grow the buckwheat here. If the buckwheat is properly milled and served fresh, you know, as a noodle, then there's, of course, a way to do it. If there's a will, there's a way. So.
And you know what they say about restaurants? Organized chaos.
Organized chaos. I'm really good at that. But if there is one, you're my first guest. How's that?
I can't wait. Thank you so much, Sonoko.
Thank you so much, Christina.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Brad Leone, the listeners have been demanding this podcast.
Wait, seriously?
No.
Oh, I got excited for a second. I've been excited.
So this started a couple of weeks ago in the test kitchen. We were talking about turnips, you and I, and I've never seen you glow as much as when talking about turnips.
Well, I thought they were going to fire me when we did the making perfect Thanksgiving, and people were throwing around sides ideas, and we landed on mashed potatoes, and I was like, oh, you know what I really like is when you mix in mashed turnips with the potatoes, or just do them on the side too. I grew up, we do a little mashed turnip.
Okay.
And it's delightful.
So how was that suggestion received?
Not well. I mean, people were close to throwing things at me. Brad, get out of the kitchen.
It was just a straight no.
Yeah. We're going to have someone else on.
All right. Full disclosure. I have eaten turnips. I think I've liked them before. And I have some thoughts about how to, obviously you have thoughts about how to prepare them, and I have some feedback. I'm not sure I've ever bought a turnip.
Well, you know, there's a few different types. And I think if someone's, I mean, when most people think of turnips, I think they think of two things. One is like the big, you know, medieval time looking turnip, you know, it's just a monster white with the purple top kind of thing. It just seems like peasant food, if for lack of better description. And I mean that in a great way. Most good things were at some point.
Or it's where comfort food comes from.
Yeah. And then the other one I think that most people, especially nowadays, at least in the United States, is the Japanese, that little real tight, crispy white one. I butcher how to say the correct name. It's like, it starts with an H. I'm literally the worst. I should have brought notes.
I'm just going to leave you out. I'm going to leave you hanging on that one.
It's fine. I'm going to roll with it. But that one, the Japanese turnip, it's fantastic. It's almost like it's so easy to prepare. You don't really need to do much with it.
And let's do this. We're going to run through your top five root vegetables. And as with turnips, give us like three ways to best prepare.
Before we go any further, we talked about this offline a little bit, but is a radish?
No, we're not doing radishes. Okay. No. Starting with turnips, give me three ways I should be cooking with turnips.
All right. Well, depending on the turnip, but we'll just do it on a broad way. Like a traditional big white regular turnip. I mean, it's really good. It's boiled. You can kind of cook it like a potato. Cook it or roast it. However, you just need to get it tender. Like that one, I don't really like el dente. You want it to, that's why I love to almost mash it, because it just takes really well to it. You can add some olive oil. You can add some pork fat. You can add, some butter, obviously, some salt.
Yeah.
And it's wonderful.
But you're not necessarily doing like the whole cream or milk thing like you do with mashed potatoes?
No, it's not really my thing.
Yeah.
But it would certainly work. And then jumping to the name I can't remember, but that Japanese.
It's almost like you would think Emma might be helping us out instead of just scrolling through Instagram right now. Uh-oh, she just LOL'd. No, but seriously, Emma, help us out.
Yeah, but seriously, Emma. So those ones are super versatile. You can cook them real, just a little salt, steamed, or slice them, quarter them, sauteed with a little olive oil or butter. You don't need to go mush. In fact, I don't like to. I'll eat them raw.
I bet you would.
You know, but just heat it up a little bit, cooked al dente, where the outside gets like, you know, soft and a little creamy on the texture, but the inside still got a nice little bite to it. And they're just delightful to eat. They're, you know, as a side, you could put them in a salad, but really I just like steaming them. I don't really like to put color on them.
Interesting, because I look at a lot of recipes, people will sort of like saute them, get them a little caramelized on the outside, but you're not digging that?
Personal preference. Like for me, like I just enjoy the root vegetable so much. Honestly, steamed with a little salt, it's like, it's a delight. It's such a perfect vegetable. And I mean, listen, roasting it with miso or something like that, it's good. It's very good. And I'm sure most people might prefer that. But me, when it comes to just high-end ingredients, I just like to let them speak for themselves.
What about whether Japanese style in a broth or like a pot-au-feu or something, putting them in a soup sort of broth situation?
It'd be great. It would be awesome in a broth. I've definitely used it as like a topping in, say, ramen or a soup or something, you know, where they can even just kind of warm up in the broth.
Yeah.
But steamed, they just get creamy, and they have like such a unique texture that is just fantastic.
Before we move on, how would you describe the flavor profile of a turnip in your words?
Sweet. I don't want to say starchy because it's not. Mm-hmm. But like it's almost starts to dance with like a radish. You know, it's like a creamy radish.
Dance with the radish. All right. Yum. I want some turnips.
And don't forget the greens. Fantastic. You can steam them. You can chop them up, saute them.
And oftentimes when you have the Japanese style hakore,
they come with it.
Yes, they have that little, like, there's always a little bit of the root, the green root on there, the tip.
Or even more so, you usually see them with the full green. Sure. I see them more with the full green than trimmed. And that's nice because you know they're fresh.
But I'm saying when you're serving them, they often always have the greens cut up, but you always have a little bit of
the green half inch nub.
Yeah, and that's nice.
And it's delightful.
All right, what do we got next, Brad?
Sweet potatoes. All types of sweet potatoes. Good for you. I love them. I grew up on them. You know, from the traditional yam to the, you know, there's so many different types, more than I even really can bring to the table. But, you know, they have the purple ones, the white ones, the golden yellow ones, you know.
I got to say this. I'm only now coming around to sweet potatoes.
Oh, they're so good. And they're so good for you.
I always, Well, talk to me, because I have thoughts, and I have thoughts about why, sort of growing up in the 70s and 80s, why I didn't, why I had a bad sort of impression of sweet potatoes.
Did your mom like cook them in the microwave or something?
My mom never made it, but you know, just like the mashed sweet potatoes and the ones with the marshmallow, it's just like too sweet and just like, so how do you like to prepare a sweet potato at home?
Yeah, I mean, listen, I'm back to being boring in a way, you know, but like sweet potatoes, awesome roasted, to the point where it usually takes a little longer. I like to wrap them in foil with a little bit of water. Okay.
Why?
So sometimes it just wants a little bit of that steam. The steam penetrates it. It gives you a creamier finish.
All right.
And then eventually I'll let that go for a little bit and then I'll open it, let the water evaporate, and then it'll start to caramelize again. Because they do caramelize fantastic. Yeah. Like a perfectly roasted whole sweet potato where the skin you can kind of just peel off and then the inside's caramelized. It's like nature's candy. It's unbelievable. A little bit of butter.
So the other day, Simone and I were having like a healthy-ish Monday night dinner, bought a couple of nice sweet potatoes. I just did like we do roast potatoes. I pierce them with the fork, rub them with olive oil, malt and salt on the outside.
Yep.
Roasted them on the rack. Although you got to be careful. You got to put something under the rack because you will get that like
sugar water,
like that syrup coming out. And that'll like just, that's not a good situation on the bottom of your oven. But I got them nice and crispy, tender in the inside. Just split them open and just butter and sea salt.
And it's all so good. It's so good.
And also we made that and I had some sauteed kale with garlic. Like I said, it was healthy-ish night. But not only was the sweet potato so satisfying, also so fulfilling/filling.
Oh, yeah.
Like I was like, I'm good. I don't need anything else.
Sticks to the ribs, as my mom would say.
And how about like steaming or, again, putting them in some steaming, sort of soup situation?
Fantastic. Soups, I love. The problem is timing with soups because they will they'll disintegrate.
See, I've had that problem before.
So like it's a timing thing. You got to get your chunk right, keep an eye on it. I like when they're like, just perfect, you know, in the soup. It's fantastic. But if it falls apart, you kind of lose it. It starts to take over the broth.
All right, so I did a Asian sort of Thai curry sort of thing the other night, and I made that mistake where I put them in too early, and by the time everything else was cooked through.
Mushed.
Are there types of sweet potatoes you would opt for steaming over or brothing over roasting, you know, like?
I think they all work. Yeah. I think they all can all. It just comes down to that kind of flavor you're chasing, like, and the texture. You know, I know the purple ones are sometimes a little more starchy, a little denser. But so maybe that would work a little better as far as holding together in a soup or a stew. But then also a great. I do this on weekdays because sometimes you just want something a little faster. I'll half it and then I'll cut it into mixed shapes, little odd shapes. Toss them with olive oil, salt.
What are you gonna say, oblong?
I don't think so. I just speak poorly. And then on a sheet tray in the oven.
Peeled or not peeled?
I don't peel them.
Okay. All right.
But you can.
And toss them in olive oil and salt?
Toss them in olive oil, salt.
So they get some color.
Get some coated and just put them on the sheet tray, cut sides. You want to get contact on the sheet. And they'll pick up that one face on the sheet tray, picks up like that beautiful kind of, I don't want to say crispy, but like caramelized.
Yeah, because they've got so much sugar in them.
And then everything else just stays nice and creamy, and they're done, as opposed to roasting it whole, which can, take some time. It
takes a while.
I mean, you're talking 30 minutes, maybe even, depending on the temperature.
So we have this recipe on our Healthy-ish website right now by your colleague and good friend, Andy Baragani.
Oh, golden boy himself.
Wildly popular recipe that we put up a few months ago. Charred sweet potatoes with hot honey butter and lime.
Home run.
Did you taste this one when Andy was developing it?
Fantastic.
And that you split lengthwise, and then you've got, and it's like some, but how did you make this one? You got the hot sauce, you got the butter, you got the lime, so it gets that sort of caramelly crispness on the outside, and then you've got some pepitas and everything on there, and again, it just looks amazing, and everyone I know on staff who has made this.
Like you said before, they are so satisfying and fulfilling in a way that you can, I mean, listen, we're all, I'm speaking for myself, I guess, but like, I'm always drawn, maybe it's because of how I was brought up, or like, we don't usually, or very often, just have a straight vegetarian meal. Yeah. It's like, I'll make a sweet potato, but like, oh, I want like chicken, or like, maybe it's just a habit, but like, you're always kind of used to having like a main course or a protein with it. Mm-hmm. But with sweet potatoes, like that dish you were just talking about with Andy there, that little bowl, not to be Mr. Starch here, but a little bowl of rice or something. I can call that dinner.
Yeah.
Simple. No problem.
Yeah. So maybe some little
put an egg on it.
I would do a bowl of rice, maybe also on, I would do a nice bowl of white rice and also some like chopped up little scallions.
Beautiful.
So you got a little bite. You got the lime. You got the honey. You got the hot sauce. You got the pepitas.
An egg would not be terrible.
Egg's never terrible.
No.
All right, Brad, number three. What percentage of our listeners do you think cook with rutabaga?
Oh, percentage?
Yeah.
Not good. not good. I don't even think we're in the single digits. It's probably a 0.5%. But maybe not. You know what? I'm going to go out there. Maybe we'll do a little poll. We'll get old Rachel Carton to do a poll on the social medias. But I would say 3%.
Okay. So why should more BA listeners and users and readers be cooking with rutabaga?
Actually, hold on. Before I answer that question, I am reassessing my guess. Magazine, you know, I think we have some, you know, my folks have been subscribers for a long time. I know we have a lot of, you know, what's the nice way to say this, older generations of viewers and readers.
I'll take that, sure.
And I do believe some of our older readers or fans, they probably watch it. So I'm going to say 6.5%, final answer.
Okay, so what should describe rutabaga for those who are not cooking with them, and what should I like about them? Because, and by the way, there are so few, if any, rutabaga recipes at all on bonappetit.com. I'm looking now. Like, there's other root Those vegetables recipes, and this might pop up in them, but in terms of recipes that actually have rutabaga in the title,
I'm telling you, it's going to come back. After this podcast,
all right,
you watch.
All right.
Restaurants all across the world. But no, those recipes probably died in like the 1800s or something. You need an old book, you know? This was like Great Depression vegetables. But it's kind of, I mean, it almost looks, from the outside, I feel like it can be confused with just that traditional big turnip, because mm-hmm. it kind of has that like white kind of purpley skin on the outside.
Yep.
It's massive, but on the inside, it's, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's like yellow.
Yeah, it has a very beautiful golden hue.
Oh, it's good. I'm excited.
That when mashed, it really takes on a beautiful picture. But on the outside, it's that part purple, part white sort of deal.
The way I would do it I'm going to start fooling around with it more and experimenting, actually. I've been inspired. But I've only ever had it as a mash, I think.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's almost like a mix between like that big regular turnip and the Japanese, it has, and it's almost like squashy in a way, like an acorn squash, mm-hmm. in a way, because it has like texture. It's not just mush. It's got like
some fiber.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And, with that, with salt and butter, a little olive oil, I just really like it. And I think it's really, really underutilized.
Well, I mean, it's interesting now that I think about it. Like, I think the average shopper who is not well versed in root vegetables, and obviously certain shoppers who cook more of certain cuisines are, but if someone who isn't, it's like, you already know how to cook a potato.
Right.
What you're dealing with is not that different. So whether you're getting a turnip or a rutabaga, like, same basic game plan. And like, there's no reason to not, mess around. Like, try mashing, try
big,
roasting.
Hard, starchy vegetable.
Need some salt and olive oil, and you're probably going to be all right. Or a little butter. Yeah. And it's like, look it up online and start playing with it. All right, rutabaga. This next one, big fan. The French are big fans of it, certainly. Definitely was like a thing back in the 90s. Celery root.
Yeah. I mean, not to just be a one-trick horse here, or pony, or whatever the saying is. But you see it all the time, pureed.
Yes.
It goes great with butter, with cream, with salt, pepper, stuff like that, obviously. But I really enjoy it steamed, too, like cubed or staked. I just thought of this. I would love to cut it into, like the way you would cut rounds, thick rounds for like an eggplant parmesan.
Mm.
I would love to cut it into that, steam it al dente, toss it in a little oil, and then sear it a steak.
Oh, yes.
A little salt.
A little color.
Meow.
I like, so this is, from the outside, this is all knobby and just like gnarled looking.
And
you got to peel it and really sort of with a firm peeler. Some of the problems I've had when I've done like a celery root potato mash, or mash or puree, which I think I was referring to the 90s where for a while everyone was doing short ribs. They would do like short ribs with a reduced stock on a celery root potato puree.
Yeah.
Just getting the timing down of how long it takes for the celery root to sort of boil versus the potato and what size chunks and whatnot.
Right.
And so I would just do, if you're going to do that, make sure you have the timing down so one doesn't get waterlogged or underdone.
I would cook them separately.
Yeah, that's probably, I would too. And I've done it before together and I always screw it up.
Yeah, because they do cook. That's a great point, actually, because they will cook separately at different times.
Also with celery root, I love celery root remoulade, mm-hmm. which is sort of a French celery root sort of coleslaw, if you will.
Creamy.
Creamy, the shredded root, maybe a little bit of greens.
It's raw.
Yeah. Okay. And it's just like an excellent sort of accoutrement to some kind of a lunchtimey, if you may have some charcuterie or something going on there.
Refreshing, crunchy.
Exactly. Delicious.
That sounds nice.
Strongly recommend.
Oh, I like that. Easy. And I mean, the thing that's great about basically all of these that we're talking about, these root vegetables, is that they're all pretty affordable.
Well, yeah, very affordable. Yeah. And again, if you know how to make one, you probably know how to make all of them.
Exactly.
Also great with the celery root remoulade. Oftentimes, apple is mixed in there.
Okay.
Yeah. But it's also 1890s.
Right. Totally.
Back Ferdinand Plant and those guys back in France. So strongly recommend that. I hope that was a correct French chef reference. Final one. Not a beet fan. Don't None like beets. Simone made beets last night. She roasted them. She put them in the salad. She was trying to get Marlon to eat a beet. He didn't want to eat it. Turned into a whole thing at the table. And I was like, you know what? I don't want to eat it either.
I love the flavor. I love the texture. I love the different types. The golden, the chioga, or the, you know, the candy cane ones.
Yeah, those are pretty.
Cold, hot, salty, spicy, sweet, you name it.
I don't like the sweetened. I just, yeah.
Pickled. I could eat beets 5 days a week.
Really?
Oh, they're so good. But everyone has had this experience. This is, you know, nothing. But, you know, no, it does. Everyone remembers the first time they've eaten like a lot of red beets or something. And, you know, you go to the bathroom. And it's like when, you know, I remember being young and it happened. And I was like, oh, boy. Like
I'm dying. I
need to go to the hospital. And it's like, it's a very normal thing.
Your mom should have warned you.
Someone should have.
So, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I guess, again, 4 out of 5 is not bad. I love everything else. But for some reason about beets, and I feel like as a kid who didn't like vegetables, I've come a long way.
You have.
I'm a vegetable forward sort of eater these days. But beets is just one of those things. There's something about the sweetness of them. I just don't like a sweet vegetable.
Like that sweet mineraliness. Kind
yeah. I just like, and then the texture, I just can't. I've tried. And for some reason, it's like the one vegetable I can't embrace.
Oh, and that's another one. And back to your point, you can kind of treat these all the same, right?
I think beets is a bit of an outlier. All the other ones you would mash, all the other ones you would roast that take on a little color or steam. Beets you roast, you know, skin on in a like foil, whatever. You're going to peel, then chop up. I don't know.
I don't like too much al dente. Like, no. You want them to be tender.
I don't want that. Yeah, and you don't want the skin. I don't know. Somehow beets, I think, obviously people who love beets. You know what I do like, actually? Which we get from Marlin, and then now I steal half of. We always buy beet ginger like juice at the market to try to get him some vegetables. Like,
he'll drink that.
It's like beet, ginger, apple. You know, that's
red beet.
Red beet. So it looks just like a red. We just call it red juice cocktail. You know, and it's like I like to do that on the nights I'm not drinking.
Okay.
Half club soda, half beet juice, and so you can actually make cocktails obviously with it. Also,
beet juice upsets a lot of people's stomachs.
It really?
Yeah, you remember the wonderful Sue Lee?
Yeah, love Sue Lee.
She could not. I used to drink some. It was a mixture of. It was like beet ginger.
Yeah,
juice that I got somewhere, and she could not drink it. She said she would get like very nauseous, and so I think that's a common thing for raw beet juice to bother people.
Huh. Well, I'm glad I don't have the problem.
Your kid, he'll drink that.
He'll drink that.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting.
You
guys like beets.
He's difficult with everything else. Well, that's what Simone figures. Like, you like beet juice, so you'll like beets. And he's like, took one bite. And was
beet
just,
juice is so much harder to consume than actual beets.
Interesting. Yin and yang, you and I.
Hey, man. What's the word I'm looking for? The whole circle, the whole pie, or something like that? Exactly.
All right. So, anyways, it's January, people. Most parts of the country, it's cold and crappy out. Go buy some root vegetables. Try a new root vegetable tonight. If you never had rutabaga, go eat some rutabagas. Yeah. You know,
it's all about the rutabaga.
Yeah, turnips. Yeah, I imagine most people have sweet potatoes. But, you know, try something new. You already know what you're doing.
And especially nowadays, there's so many more different options out there. Even just in, you know, when I was younger, you had to go to a farmer's market and, like, know what you were looking for to find a purple sweet potato or, you know, one of those, like, white-fleshed sweet potatoes. But now they're kind of, like, in almost, like, all supermarkets, which is fantastic. And rutabagas, too, if you look. People just walk past them. And I'm calling it. I'm going to single-handedly try to make rutabagas popular.
Your start's right here. Thanks, Brad.
Thank you.
I'm Alex Beggs, and this is Cook, Marry, Kill. Cook. refried beans. I made part of the basically chicken tinga tostada recipe this weekend, the refried bean part, and I will cook them forevermore. First, you cook chopped up bacon and onion together until everything's crispy good. Add 2 cans of black beans and their goopy can liquid, boil it, let the liquid cook down, and then smash it with a potato masher and have breakfast tacos all week. As Justin Bieber would say, yummy yum. Mary. I'd like to marry the Joan, which is the name of a drink at the Riddler, a champagne bar in New York and San Francisco. Well, the Joan is less of a drink and more of a pour. It's a glass of house wine poured all the way to the rim of the glass, where it sort of shimmers and ripples until you sip it to a safe level. Some people see the glass of life as either half empty or half full, but when you drink the Joan, you might see life as double full, or maybe that's your vision losing focus. Either way, everything's looking up. And economically speaking, it's an amazing deal. It's $16, the equivalent of 2.5 glasses of wine, plus it's good wine from a fancy wine bar where you should also order a burger. I'll never divorce you, Joan. You can read more about it in the highly recommend column on bonappetit.com. Kill. Speaking of wine and undying love, this week I want to kill the wine tariff that might be implemented if the Trump administration's proposed 100% tax on imported European wines passes in Congress. And weirdly, this comes from trade disputes between aircraft companies? It's very confusing and stupid. You can read more about the details in pieces by Eric Asimov and Jenny Lefcourt in the New York Times, but the biggest takeaway is that some of the best wine in the world, hello, all of France, is about to disappear from stores or get very expensive. It could mean a $20 bottle is now $40. The New York Times said there'd be disastrous ripple effects. I only want the top of my very full glass of wine to ripple. But this isn't about my questionable personal life. It affects the people who grow and pick the grapes, the restaurants who serve and, yeah, profit from these wines, the whole damn industry. I didn't even get into the tariffs on other goods like olive oil, cheese, and tinned fishes, which go really well with those wines. Gah, call your Congress people, scream and shout, kill this tariff.
The Bon Appetit Foodcast is produced and edited by Emma Wortsman, with additional programming help from Carrie Polis and Elise Inamine. Our theme music is by Nathaniel Wortsman. We have new episodes every Wednesday, and if you want to reach out to us about this episode or any other episode, email us at bonappetitfoodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.